Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Barry Mishkin is with us. You may know him from thebdr.net or oldradio.com or from his wonderful lunchtime meetings where engineers get together and talk tech. It's coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, worry-free transmission you can count on with outstanding control, reliability, efficiencies, and Nautel's unmatched 24/7 customer support, online at Nautel.com. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone. I guess the only one I got is this one, and the light bulb at the top of the tower, which right now is a two-hour flight away in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack. Delighted that you're here. Delighted you could join us for our 581st episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Where am I, you may ask? I know you don't care, but where am I? I'm stuck in a hotel room. I am all cozied up in a hotel room in Dallas, Texas, because they canceled all the flights last night. And so many people didn't get where they were going, including me. And I was very lucky, very blessed and fortunate to get this hotel room not far from Dallas Love Field. So they canceled all the flights at Dallas Love today, apparently. And I'm not leaving until Friday afternoon. So, oh well. Thank goodness for a credit card and for the Sonesta Inn. That's enough about me. We can do the show from almost anywhere, proving that again. Chris Tarr is here, and he's in kind of his usual spot, his hangout, his den of luxury. Chris, welcome in. Good to see you.
Better known as the basement, my office.
Oh.
You know, it's about as glorious as the glorious destinations that you've been visiting, Kirk. Live from an undisclosed hotel somewhere, which is, by the way, not the first time we've gotten video calls from Kirk somewhere in a hotel room that he's not telling us about. So, you know, this is kind of par for the course. You're like, oh, Kirk's in a hotel room again. Go figure. So, as long as you're alone this time, we'll be good.
But since COVID, I've not been traveling much. Yeah, I used to kind of, on a semi-regular basis, pop up from a hotel room to do the show, even on vacation, even in Mexico. I've done the show from Mexico. I've done the show from various places around the world, even from a TV studio in Nashville, Tennessee, when I was at Fox 17. But so this is kind of interesting to be on the road. The one time I take off is, we have an ice storm. But I understand there's people that are hurting in terms of, just weather and not getting around all over the country. I got notice that Telos Alliance in Cleveland, if you work in the Cleveland office, they said, hey, don't come in Friday, out of an abundance of caution. We're not going to come in. And even the people who can't work from home, like people in the shipping department, very graciously, our Cleveland office said, hey, don't worry, you'll get paid.
It's interesting. I had to call ERI today to order some gaskets for an antenna that I'm having rebuilt on Monday. And same thing, I called and they're like, well, I'm working at home. We're going to try to get into the office tomorrow and get it out to you. But, as of today, obviously, nothing's getting shipped out. They're in Indiana. Mm. And, nothing's getting shipped out today. But hopefully tomorrow afternoon, we'll be able to get it out to you. But we'll take your information. And I'm like, I've been there. Take your time. Don't worry about it. We want everybody safe. This is just something. It's from Texas all the way up to the East Coast. It's one of the largest storm bands in recent history. It's amazing.
It is amazing. Speaking of amazing, our guest is Barry Mishkin. I'm so glad, Barry, that you could join us. Welcome in. Good to see you.
Oh, hi, Kirk. Nice to be here.
That's a nice mic. What is that, Barry?
It's a Shure MV7.
Oh. Is that new mic that is USB and dynamic?
Yes, it is. That's the one.
Oh, cool. I'd never seen one in person. Well, this way before. I've never seen in person either. Hey, so Barry Mishkin, a lot of you may know. I know Barry from a fairly narrow slice of his life. And there's so much about Barry that I don't know, and probably you don't either. But, Barry used to organize those Thursday lunch gatherings at the NAB show that were so popular, so well attended, and a great camaraderie. And Barry, you're doing the same thing virtually now. Before we take our first quick break, Barry, tell us what you'd like for us to know about you.
Oh, goodness. I've been in broadcasting far too long. Started on the air in high school and worked my way through a couple of markets. Eventually ended up doing engineering and tech stuff, contract engineering, writing. Goodness, I started writing in the 70s. Still keep going. Right now, it's so, the BDR.
Yeah, right, but the Broadcaster's Desktop Reference, great resources there. And, of course, your lunch gatherings. And I've been able to attend a few of those. What a fantastic group of engineers who show up for that. We're going to ask Barry more about what he's doing and how you and I and other engineers can participate in that, because I'm telling you, it's quality stuff. I would put, you know, This Week in Radio Tech about here, honestly, and I would put Barry's Lunch Gathering up about here in terms of quality of information. It's good, good stuff. So we're going to be right back with Barry. Hey, I want to let you guys know that Nautel is continuing their Transmission Talk Tuesdays. Just go to nautel.com/webinars to register. Here's a quick tip from Jeff Welton from a previous show.
So what are the kind of things you would put in a comfort kit for, I mean, I know one thing obviously comes to mind, but what would you guys use?
Yeah, definitely the toiletries are important, which I'm sure is what you were getting at. But you probably want some non-perishable food in there for one, just to make sure that you're, you know, you've got something at site that you can use to kind of sustain yourself. I don't know that this necessarily, maybe this is separate from your comfort kit, but definitely water as well. Keep water on site. Ideally, your site's not going to be in a situation where it gets below freezing and the water will freeze, but there are solutions to that as well. Just things like towels, things like, stuff to clean your hands, things to, Yeah, I think, you know, for instance, I mean, the kit that they show here is actually a pretty good start.
Nautel.com/webinars. You can sign up for Transmission Talk Tuesdays, and they've got them all scheduled for the month of February. You can schedule yourself. They're easy to join, and you can, and it's not a webinar. It is actually a roundtable discussion. It's terrific to participate in. A lot of thanks to Nautel for putting these together. So many educational resources. I mean, there's This Week in Radio Tech, there's Barry's virtual lunchtime gathering, and there's the Nautel Transmission Talk Tuesdays. Okay, Kirk here in Dallas, Texas, holed up in a hotel room. Chris Tarr is in his basement, and Barry Michigan is here. And Barry, again, delighted to have you with us. I guess you and I have known each other for a long time. First of all, perhaps through the lunchtime meeting at NAB. Where's the impetus for that? How did you decide, hey, let's do something at the Riviera, bring everybody together for a buffet and just have a nice lunch? How'd you get that idea?
It was back quite a ways when computing was just pretty new to the broadcast industry. We're talking about the late 80s. And I found that there were a number of people that tried to figure out a lot of the early stuff, what computer to use, what software, how to understand the very early networking and such before we even dealt with the internet. And so I arranged for us to get together at the East Riviera Tuesday noon, and it became a thing. We would have anywhere from 60 to 120 folks. They'd network, answer questions for one another, and learn things, and it just seemed to grow from year to year.
Chris Tarr, did you ever get to go to any of those luncheons at NAB?
I did. I went to one. It's probably been, 15 years or so now. But it was great. Uh-huh. You know, a lot of good camaraderie, a lot of good information there. So absolutely.
When I page through all my my photos that are I keep online at what Google Photos or whatever, probably got 100,000 pictures there, I'm always delighted when I find something that came from there. I'll type in Las Vegas as the location. And of course, there's lots of stuff from the show floor and, you know, riding a few rides or something like that, or maybe a fine steak dinner. But then to see things from Barry's Tuesday lunchtime gathering was really cool. So Barry, since we couldn't go to NAB, at some point you started the virtual Thursday lunch meeting. Tell me about the impetus for that.
Well, that's exactly it. When this pandemic stuff started, in 2020, I knew that the NAB wasn't going to happen. It got cold off pretty fast. And so I figured, well, if we can't have the Tuesday lunch at NAB, let's do something here on the internet where Zoom can bring us together. And Thursday seemed to be the best day for it in the week. We tried Friday. That wasn't good. We tried Wednesday. That didn't work as well. But Thursday seemed to fit most people. And so we've been doing this now for almost 2 years straight.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that long. When you started, did you start using the Zoom platform?
Yes, that was the first Zoom. There were a few people that didn't like the idea of Zoom because, well, there's been some questions about security and things like that. But I'm not sure that people in China really need to know how to read an Autel transmitter.
Yeah. We're not discussing our subordinated debentures or stock picks or anything like that. So how... And with your Zoom platform, one thing that is really refreshing or different about it than, say, this podcast is, you know, the members of the audience, all the people that participate, well, they can turn their cameras off if they want to, but they can have their camera on. And I guess anybody can ask a question about any time, right? I mean, it's almost a roundtable discussion if they want to participate.
It can be. It depends on the week and the presenter. Some of the presenters like to be able to work their way through their presentation without interruption. Others want questions whenever they come up into some person's mind. And so, generally speaking, I turn all the microphones off when we get started because background noise, telephones, wives, things like that. And yet I invite anybody to hit their little alternate A or space bar and ask a question. Or we have the chat for those that feel a little bit more inhibited.
Okay, so you mentioned your presenters. How do you choose people to present? Because it's so often it's something really interesting. You get top-notch people, the biggest and brightest in our industry to come speak to your group. How does that work for you?
Well, oddly enough, as I explain to the folks that agree to come on, my impetus came from a character in the TV show NCIS New Orleans. And if you've seen that or anyone has seen it, the character by Scott Bakula, typically as he talked to his team, his phrase was, learn things. I said, well, okay, let's learn some things. And the idea being that if we came away with one or two things that we didn't know before, we really win.
Gotcha. Okay. I noticed you've had, you've had like some luminaries. I think Frank Foti was on recently. Jeff Welton. Jeff Welton's on pretty often, I suppose. What are a couple of the more unusual topics? Or maybe I should ask, you know, there's a lot of straight ahead broadcast oriented topics, but have you had people on who are tangentially associated with broadcasting, things that engineers probably ought to know anyway, but they're not necessarily straight ahead broadcasting?
Sure. We've tackled several topics, such as construction of studios, construction of transmitter sites, maintenance things. So we've had some folks that do architectural aspects, people that talk about generators, people that will talk about the different things that relate to the site itself in terms of security, talking about the home studios right now isn't the biggest thing because everybody's sort of getting used to it, but there have been changes. And as we come out of the pandemic, I don't think we're all going back to the main studio. I think it's going to continue with a lot of remote broadcasting, which means that everything from the software involved to internet security and getting the product back to the studio is going to be important.
Well, okay. Barry, you mentioned that you've done a lot of contract engineering over your life and career. Are you still consulting and doing actual screwdriver turning these days?
A little less than I used to. I maintain stations and consult for a pair of Native American tribes that have five or six stations right now. So some of them are door to door, 100 and some miles, and some of them are a little closer. But we do a lot, just like you do and everyone else these days, telephone, video, try to solve problems as you go.
You know, I want to bring Chris Tarr in if he's available, because we're living in this time when we're at this interesting hybrid of virtual work. I mean, it's all kind of work, but right, virtual presence at our work, doing things remotely, but some things, you know, still happen at, you know, at the location. An example I just gave, my employer, Telos Alliance, they're closing the building on Friday for their share of the storm, but everybody can work from home will be working from home. Chris, what are you finding about at your stations that where you're the director of engineering? What are your thoughts about this hybrid we have at the moment of virtual work, and what do you see? How do you see that changing coming up, Chris?
Well, we have gone completely, completely remote, and I don't think we're actually going to go back. It seems to be working really, really well. And there are some, you know, nice side benefits too. We found that we've been able to downsize some of our buildings because we just don't need all of that space. So we've been actually able to pick up, you know, move into some smaller but nicer facilities, rebuild studios because we don't need as many. And we find that we have a lot better productivity from our coworkers because, you know, they can work when it strikes them. You know, as opposed to, well, you're here from 8 to 5 and you need to work between 8 and 5, even if that isn't your most productive time. You know, what we're doing now is, hey, you know, work when you want, as long as the stuff is getting done and, you know, it's getting done, you know, on time and well, it doesn't matter to us when you work. There's really no reason for you to have to work between certain hours and be sitting at a desk. I remember when I interviewed for this job, and the owner said to me, you know, I said, well, where am I going to work out of? Because we have stations all over the state. And he said, why would you work out of an office? You know, why would you sit there all day? And, you know, we have stations all over the place. You know, there's really no reason for you to be anywhere. So, you know, nowadays with IP phones and virtual, you know, meeting rooms and things like that, there's really no reason to be in a building other than, you know, again, sometimes there is face-to-face meetings or people want to get out to do things. And in that case, we have that option. We have these nicer, smaller facilities where we have desks and phones and, you know, copy machines and things where people can check in and work for the day if they want. So, you know, it is kind of a hybrid, but we've leaned a lot more into the technology side. And that's what I want to hear really Barry's take, because Barry, you were really kind of first to grasp the internet for everything. I mean, you've been around for so long with your teaching and your sharing of information over the internet. You were really one of the earlier adopters of that.
Well, yes, I suppose that's true. Back in, I guess it was 1988, I got the broadcast list when we were still doing BBS bulletin board systems. So I took that over in 1988. We moved it to the internet in the mid-90s when that became a little more usable and accessible. And at the same time, I've been writing since the late 70s, talking about everything from tech to managerial to whatever strikes, you know, history, whatever strikes my fancy. That's why they called me the eclectic engineer. They don't always know where I'm coming from or where I'm going.
Sure. Now in your conversations with, you know, on these Thursdays and with our peers, where do you see this kind of hybrid work going? You know, is it kind of the same way that I've been looking at it, or have you seen something different?
Well, I see many of the same things that you're talking about. Many of the companies are closing down their large studios to save on rent and save on equipment. I think that it was very interesting how there was this huge buildup of studios, and especially the consolidation companies, and then of empty places. You could literally shoot the proverbial cannon off and nobody would be hit. Like Thursday at the NAB, and it was just empty. But I think that, as you say, the flexibility options and opportunities, if we set it up properly, I think they're amazing, because, yeah, there are going to be some folks that will be on the air at their appointed time. And then there are going to be other people that are doing production and programming, voice tracking, that they can do at whatever time is best for them to do it, and then ship it back to the collection point to get it into the integrated into the automation.
It's interesting. We had a gentleman who does some voice tracking for us, was a big name at one of the Milwaukee stations, you know, for one of the big radio groups. And one of the things that he was, he actually, as opposed to getting downsized and coming to us, he came to us to switch positions, because one of the things that he liked is he wanted to be able to work from home. And the ability to voice track and work from home to him was well worth it, because he didn't want to have to drive in every day and do those things. So we're also finding that it's a good way to attract talent, because we can offer that, you know, we can offer that option. You know, we're advertising for account executives. And one of the things we talk about in the ad is, hey, you know, part of the time you could be working from home. And I think a lot of people find that ideal. And technology's gotten to the point, I think, Barry, you were saying, technology's gotten to the point where we can do that pretty easily. And, you know, we did have in the consolidation era, you know, this whole big, you know, building all of these beautiful facilities and studios, and then realized, I think, after looking at that, and the pandemic has helped, you know, we really don't need people in the building. And radio was kind of the last huge industry to kind of see that, to kind of see that remote working was really actually could work. And I think, you know, as you know, Barry, although you were very early in, radio has been very slow technology-wise to catch up with the rest of the world. You know, it was for many years into, you know, the 90s, early 2000s, sometimes the only computer was in the accounting's office, you know, in accounting. Mm. So, yeah. You know, we were all very slow to pick up on technology. And now all of a sudden, because we've been forced into it, you know, we're looking at security and VPNs and all these different things to allow remote work. So it's been interesting to watch.
So it sure is. And in addition to that, one of the things that I'm watching for, and I haven't seen fully a lot of it yet, we're going to see new consoles. We're going to see new workstations that are designed for the home studio. Talk about programs that like to take telephone calls. Right now, it's a little bit of a kludge. Different stations have come up with different solutions, but there's no real easy plug and go, so that if you're operating out of your basement or your den studio and somebody calls you and you want to put them on the air with you, not everybody has that capability at this point. And I think some of the, well, Comrex has come up with a little program that is working, the Gaggle, if you've heard about it already. And I'm sure you folks at Telos, Kirk, are going to have something very similar very shortly. But the idea being that you use the software to make up for what can't happen. And yet you don't need a 16 or a 20 pot console. You just need the flexibility.
Good points. Good points. Hey, we're talking to Barry Mishkin on This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 581st episode. Coming up, we're going to continue talking with Barry. I'm curious about if there's any difference in the tribal radio stations that Barry works with and other, you know, commercial and non-commercial broadcasters that are non-tribal. That's going to be interesting to find out. Also, we're going to take a look at the resource that Chris Tarr mentioned that Barry put together years ago, and that's the Broadcaster's Desktop Reference. So we're going to take a look at that and ask Barry about the resources available there coming up. Our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcast Bionics and their fantastic, really cool Camera One system. We'll be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics. Designed to bring video to your audio content. Visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
And Camera One isn't the only product from Broadcast Bionics. They have a range of software, hardware things to make your production go better, to get your best moments onto social media, to promote your station, and to make your content better. So if you go to bionic.radio, yeah, that's a website, bionic.radio, you'll get to Broadcast Bionics and check them out. All right, I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tarr on This Week in Radio Tech. Our guest is Barry Mishkin. Hey, Barry, I'd like to follow up on this thing about the tribal radio, some people at stations you're taking care of right now. How have they had any different workflow through a COVID period than we've seen? Well, actually, we've seen a lot of different workflows, but how are they doing in terms of being in studio or all working remotely? What's that like for them?
Well, it's a combination of things. As you may know, the COVID virus hit the Native American reservations, nations, very hard. And so several of them, including the two here, actually stopped allowing outsiders on the nation, and even did close down many of the operations to a large extent. The Pasquayaki, for instance, right now, they're working from home, just as many stations are. And the Tohono O'odham, they are working sort of half and half, depending upon which of the facilities they have to work at.
How do you see their workflow changing in the future? Let's say COVID goes from a pandemic into an endemic, and it's something that we, you know, become pretty used to dealing with in the future, if that happens, as some people are predicting. How do you see their workflow? You see it getting back to normal? Chris Tarr said, no, we're not going back to where we were. How do you see it?
Well, the Native Americans in many areas of the country got, like everything else in history, they got the dribs and the drags. They got poor facilities. The Tohono O'odham, for instance, their nation is the size of Connecticut. And right now they have one radio station and one LPFM station to cover something that's 80-odd miles across. And it's difficult for them to not only get the essential programming and news out, council meetings, but also to preserve the native language and teach their people, both from the elders' point of view and the young person's point of view.
Okay. All right. Hey, you know, something that's been bothering me here is, you know, that Chris, you said that you don't see a return to the way we used to operate. And I can totally see that in terms of sales staff, admin staff, management. I can see that, but I do you think we're not going to get back into multi people in a studio? Because I've seen that in some other stations, people have gotten back together. But at your stations, for example, maybe you didn't have a lot of multi person morning shows. Tell me about how you see that happening or not happening, and what we lose that we used to have if we don't get back together in the same room.
Well, it's interesting as a kind of a test, I guess you should say, before all of this happened. There was a time at one of my stations where almost 2 years, one of the people from the morning show was at home and no one knew, and we didn't tell anybody. So it can be done. it can be done. And, you know, we right now, you know, our primary morning show is a husband and wife team. So they're at home and it doesn't really matter. They're next to each other. But, you know, I don't see that as being, you know, a problem. Now, obviously, flexibility is the key. So if there is a show that where people really want to be together and you really want them in the studio, you can do that. But the, you know, I think the key is we have the options now available where we don't have to do that. You know, with video and with, you know, current codecs and those sorts of things, there's really no reason that, you know, these people can't be spread out. We actually just set up a morning show for a few stations that I consult for up in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. We have one person in one station, one person in the other location. And, you know, we use a tie line Bridget to connect the two, and they have a video camera. And every morning they do a show separately, but together. And you'd never know listening to it that they're not in the same room. So, you know, again, you know, there's a question, should you do it? Can you do it? I think the thing that matters is you have the option. And as engineers, that's our job, is to be able to say, do you want to do this? Great. We can make that happen. You know, our job is to enable these creative people to work however they want to work. And if that means working remotely, that's great. If that means safely working together, then we make that happen too.
Chris, you've mentioned earlier that, Barry was one of the first people to use the internet to distribute information with the broadcaster's desktop resource. And yeah, it's like a library for engineers that you don't have to physically go to. So Barry, and I'm going to ask Suncast, if Suncast, whenever it feels like the right time, pop up some pages from Barry's website. Barry, tell us about the BDR.net.
Well, the BDR is largely an outgrowth of the 8 years I was editor of Radio Guide magazine. And I saw the ongoing changes in the industry, the way that people were accessing information and news. And I thought that it was important to bring the format to the internet, to have articles that explain how to do things, how to get them done better, who has the experience to help. And really, the whole idea of, do you have something that can be pulled up at any time of the day or night? I guess the thing that got to me was, as I wandered around the country during those years, I'd come into a station, and invariably there was a pile of magazines by the engineer's desk, and I'm going to get to it sort of thing. Or we'd have a question come up in the broadcast mailing list and somebody would ask about something. And I would say, well, we had that article in the August Radio Guide and it's on the pile. I'm going to get to it. And so I felt it was important to get this here to the internet so that people could come at whatever time they could find it and they could bring it up. And so that's what you're looking at right now. Is the front page, the menu there that is tries to be all encompassing of the different areas of information that are necessary. And we have good articles by different writers, and we invite folks to share what they know, their experiences, the equipment they've worked with. And this is where we are. This is what we try to do.
Barry, what would you say are the most popular one or two or three areas on the BDR.net?
Well, it varies. Sometimes it'll be something just historical. We're doing a series right now on centenary stations that have been licensed for 100 years or more. That would be very good. Other times we'll do something on a particular transmitter, or we'll do something on a particular audio processing system. When Frank Foti came on the presentation, had a lot of people. When Matt Herden did the brand new Nautel AUI description, we filled the room up and then some. And the articles are the things that people rely on to go back and see what it is and have a visual presentation of these particular things.
Hey, Barry, if you need to run and see how your family's doing, Chris and I will handle things for a couple of minutes if you need to do something there. We're talking to Barry Mishkin. Oh, Okay. We're talking to Barry Mishkin, Barry, the eclectic engineer. And you know, I must say, maybe he's off speaker right now. I sometimes want to say, is he the eclectic engineer or the eccentric engineer? Oh, no, wait, the eccentric engineer, that must be Chris Tarr.
Well, you know, yeah. I guess I've been called worse. You know, Barry's site is wonderful. And in fact, I just, there's the classified ads. We actually found a transmitter for one of our sites through Barry's website. So, it's a great, yeah. Oh, it's a great resource. And it's been around forever. And in fact, I did some writing for Barry when he was with Radio Guide. It's interesting, you know, the way with what Barry's been doing with the launches and with Tort and now with SBE and the program for the mentorship program. You know, the internet has come out, has created these ways to really pass along information, and I think in our industry about the right time. As we've been talking about, for years, there's no new engineers coming into the world, so we have to reach them some other way. And so it's been technology's come along at the right time to really kind of help that along, either with, you know, webinars, with webcasting, with sites for information. Barry's got his site. I've got broadcastengineering.info. There's Facebook, you know, all these different resources for engineers to get questions answered and to get help. Because, again, you know, we're not getting any more people in, and the people who are really skilled are slowly getting out of the industry. So, I try to, as much as I can, pick the minds of my senior engineers, John Zachary, Jim Zastro, and try to retain that and pass that along, through whatever means necessary. So it's great that those resources are out there for sure.
Barry, I believe Barry's back on camera. Barry, yep. I noticed that one of your sponsors on the BDR.net is also one of our sponsors here, and that's Henry Engineering. You're familiar with Hank Landsberg, right, aren't you?
Oh, boy, yes, for a long time.
He's a good guy. I'm delighted to know him, and I know we're all in good company. We'll tell you, we're going to take a quick break. Henry Engineering is a sponsor of this show through Broadcasters General Store. And the Henry Engineering Super Light, hey, Chris, I bet you've installed a bunch of those Henry Super Relays, and probably Barry has as well. The Henry Super Light is like the modern-day Super Relay. It's for controlling LED on-air lights, and you can also use it to control the LED mic-mounted lights, the ring lights or whatever you may have to do that. And it also gives you some normally closed and normally open contact closures on the Super Light. So, hey, let's say you've got a non-broadcast audio console, and you need to mute your speakers in your room when you turn the light on. You can do that with the Henry Super Light. Just run those speaker wires right through the normally closed relay outputs. Or maybe you need to turn on some other kind of light, or who knows what. Chris, what would you do with a normally open contacts on a Henry Super Light? What do you need to turn on when you turn the mic on? We used to wire it up to the capstan motor on a cassette recorder.
Yeah, not so much anymore, but for example, you know, a lot of PC based skimming devices can use parallel ports or serial ports for closures to start and stop recording. Yeah. So there you go. Or you want the morning show host to start coffee for you, have it, you know, when they turn on the mic, turn on the coffee maker. So, you know, there's all these different things you could use it for.
One of the other cool things about the Henry Superlight is that they have a little addressing system. You notice they have a couple of RJ45 connectors on the Henry Superlight. And this is not Ethernet. It's not even Studio Hub Audio. It's just a wiring scheme that lets you address these. So if you've got, maybe you've built your radio station such that you've got all your controls in a rack room, in a central wiring area. You can put your Henry Super Lights in the central wiring area, or have, you know, them above each door transom, for example, where your on-air light might be. And you can just run a piece of Cat 5 cable from unit to unit to unit, and this will address each one. And you can let's say you have something like an Axia X node giving you contact closures from your different studios. Well, this just makes it easy. It involves an easier wire run to get that. They label it Control Link IO, and this is easily explained in the Henry Engineering Manual. By the way, the manual, it's one page. It's, I think it's printed on both sides, but it's one page. Now, I know I've talked a lot about this thing, the Henry Superlight on a LED on-air light controller. You know, Henry has a huge range of things. Go to henryeng.com. Henry ENG, as in Henry Engineering, henryeng.com, and look at the wide variety of cool things they have. Audio products, USB products. They even have a little audio mixer. If you just need a little audio mixer to do a little job, man, they got it right there. They also have a whole sports broadcasting system that you ought to check out. And it's available, of course, from Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc. Now, what I like about Broadcasters General Store is, you know, hey, we do so much on the internet these days. Sometimes I just want to talk to somebody. I want a real human voice who knows about broadcast gear, who can easily, you know, get the financial transaction taken care of and get your estimated delivery date and talk to you about what delivery method you'd like. Well, call them. Call Broadcasters General Store at 352-622-7700. That's 352-622-7700. Yeah, I got that committed to memory. And not just for this show. I actually had that number memorized 25, 30 years ago. Not 40. No, it hadn't been that long. Anyway, long time to talk to Broadcasters General Store.
I work with Gary at Broadcasters General Store, Gary Tibbett. And I'll tell you, one of the great things about working with them, and especially Gary, and I ran into this about a week or two ago as I'm doing this studio build out in La Crosse. I didn't really even know what I wanted. I went to Gary and I said, Gary, I'm building this studio and I need some speakers and I need, you know, this floor rack to fit under a cabinet. You know, I'm kind of thinking, you know, and he comes back. He says, well, great. Here are all your options. You tell me what you need, what you like. Here's what I recommend. You know, I've heard from people that these are junk, so don't really buy those, but I'm giving it to you anyway as an option. And, you know, so I tell him what I need. He gets me the confirmation. Day or two later, I get the shipping information from him, and it's done. You know, more than once over the years, I've called Gary from the car and go, I don't know what I want, but here's what I need something to do. And, you know, he takes care of it. They're great problem solvers.
They are. And that's, you know what, you've used the people at salespeople at BGS the same way I have, which is to say, hey, what's popular? Okay, what are people sending back? Because I don't want that. What are people calling you up later and complaining about? I don't want that. I want the good stuff that I can afford. So, yeah, it's really, really helpful. All right. Thanks a lot to Broadcasters General Store for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tarr here. And our guest, delighted to have him on here with us, is Barry Mishkin. Barry, you know, I've run through my list of questions. I'd love to hear you pontificate a little bit on the state of broadcast engineering and knowledge dissemination. This really seems to be the part of the world that you are in with the BDR.net and the lunchtime at NAB and now the virtual lunch on Thursdays. Talk to us a bit about that. I'm just all ears. I want to hear your philosophies on what motivates you to do this and what joy or what frustration you get out of, you know, getting broadcast engineering information out to your friends and people and colleagues in the industry.
Oh, quite so. Actually, Chris had a very good point there about the need for getting information as engineers age out or are riffed. I tell people the story over and over again. Nautel's user group about, 4 or 5 years ago, one of the guys got up and said, how many of you are under 50? Raise your hand. And actually, there are enough hands to maybe fill one hand out of 450 people, which gives you an idea of the problem. It's much more lucrative to go into IT and you're not on call 24/7. And it's the people that really have radio in their blood that are the ones that have become the engineering force in full. Many of the experienced folks have left us. And so I felt that it was important to have a resource where information about what will work, what can be made to work, and how to go about doing it was important to find. And I've had several of the manufacturers call me and say, how can we help you? And this is really why the BDR got started, why the presentations have been good, because folks have been very willing to share their knowledge, their experience, and help us buy that to be better engineers ourselves and to help the new folks. It was last month, I think, sometime or in December, I was asked to participate in an AES program about finding and training the new folks. And we did that as a presentation on the BDR as well, because how do you find people that want to come and be an engineer in broadcasting, given what we know? Would you ask your children to go into radio engineering? And the question really gets a frown from a lot of people because of the pressures, because of the cost cutting, because of the constant, go back 30, 40 years, and the average engineer worked one or two stations, maybe. Maybe there's a staff of four or five engineers for one station. Now it's not uncommon for one guy to be taking care of six, seven, eight, maybe more. And he doesn't have time to educate himself the way he used to. He has to really put the fires out to know whom to call, where to find the information. And that's kind of my mission, is to bring them together in that way.
When I first became familiar with the BDR.net, Barry, I tended to look up pictures and manuals of older equipment. To me, that seems a bit of a labor of love. It brings back the broadcast engineering world kind of with some rose-colored glasses. Is that a part of it that you have enjoyed, is putting older gear on the site?
You're largely talking about oldradio.com, the old radio project.
Well, yeah, you know what? Thank you. Yes, oldradio.com. That's the site I'm thinking of.
And that's still there, and I do add things to it from time to time. The problem being between the BDR, the radio stations, and my mother, I don't have a heck of a lot of time left over each week. And the problem is also finding good pictures of some of the equipment that's no longer in use or being trashed. And I ask for a lot of volunteers, and some folks submit it and share what they have. And then there's some holes out there that I'd love to fill.
Wow. There's not a list of holes to fill, is there, that folks could peruse and say, hey, I've got that?
Well, go up on oldradio.com, look in the hardware directory, and pick a manufacturer. And you'll see pretty quickly what I have and what I need.
You know, Chris, Tara, you probably have some ideas too. Something that I would love to find some more information about are a line of audio consoles that looked suspiciously like LPB consoles. And they had the brand name on them, Shane and Young. Shane and Young, which is the name of a general store in Pine Knob, Kentucky. And so, how did the name of a general store get on a line of audio consoles? And by the way, the whole line of audio consoles had names of American Indians, like the Cherokee or the Sioux. And at several different radio stations I worked at in my career, early on as a disc jockey, and then later as a engineer and actually as a general manager of a little station, that in Kentucky, Shane and Young consoles were all over the place. And they were built by a fellow named Hannes Shane. And I really intend to get Hannes as a guest on our show. And I went and visited him recently. I thought that would be just a really big part of his life. I figured he'd have a big old museum full of Shane and Young consoles. Nope. He's got a couple of that are in pieces. And it's not really a part of his life. I'd love to find some information, better pictures of these consoles. Chris,
what I find interesting and what I love about, you know, oldradio.com and some of these other things, and I try to, you know, explain this, and I kind of laugh when I say younger engineers, because at 52, I'm one of the younger engineers. But I like to pass on that, you know, it's easier to know where you're going by looking at where you've been. And, you know, I think that looking back at some of these designs and some of these transmitters and this old gear give you a better understanding of where we're at now. And, you know, you may not have to go in a line of cart deck anymore, but it's good to know what they are and what they're about. And a great story I tell is, you know, a couple of years ago, I had an intern who is, you know, from the local college, and he said to me, why are these called carts when you're looking at the decks on the playback machine? You know, they're files. And, you know, but we call them carts. What is, why do you have a cart number? What is a cart? And, you know, so I went back and explained, you know, it's your take cartridge, here's this and that. But, you know, I do find that, you know, first of all, it's, you know, the whole knowing, you know, our history and where we've been. But it also, it certainly to me, gives me a much better sense of respect for those who have been there. Because I'll tell you, you know, some things don't change. RF is RF, towers are towers, and that sort of thing. But, you know, you look back at some of these transmitters, and some of them are homebrewed, and some of this gear that we've used, you know, today most things are plug and play and disposable. You know, you get a new processor, you throw it in. You have a transmitter, you swap a module. You know, that wasn't always the case, and we had some really, really skilled people in our history that could make these things work. But, you know, I think today there are some people who forget about that. You know, oh, transmitter's easy. You just swap out whatever's broken. And, you know, that may be true today, but there was a whole line of people before us that really paved the way. And so, yeah, long story short, I mean, that's one of the, you know, not only is it interesting to see, but I love the history part of that. And I love seeing where we've been and looking at how that has shaped where we are now.
You have a lot of people that don't know. And it's true. We have a fairly interesting conversation, a thread on the broadcast list over the last week or so about turntables, about slip queuing, cue burn, things that the younger crowd never heard of. And
playing the record wet to get rid of the cue burn.
I told the story that when I was on the air here back in my high school days, we were playing Petula Clark and Matt Munro and Sergio Mendez. And there was this great record, I thought, Night and Day by Sergio Mendez in Brazil 66. And it was so apropos. It sounded like they were in a rainforest. And the music was coming right out of this rainforest. And I discovered it was 35 seconds of cue burn. When they put a new copy of it in there and it was missing. And I, where's the jungle?
With cue-burned records, you were never quite sure, is this record cue-burned because it's really popular, we play it a lot, or is it cue-burned because it was pressed on some really crappy vinyl?
Yeah.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay. Also, you learn to slip cue. You learn about velvet, and you learn about 16-inch turntables and how you got a 45 to play on one of those.
And the gear shift for the speed changes.
Oh, yeah. We were allowed to come down to one of the radio stations, and they gave us 3 hours in the afternoon to do whatever we wanted to do. It was a classical music station, basically, but they let us play rock or whatever in the afternoon. And I remember one day I came in, and there was a memo that the GM handed me, came from the night guy. And he says, when those high school kids leave, tell them to put the turntables back at 33. They left it at 45, and I was halfway through a concert tonight, and I had to check with my strobe to discover it was the wrong speed.
Wow. I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, how about you check that yourself, dude? gosh, what was I? I had a question for you, Barry. I had a kind of going back to the larger subject of education and sharing of knowledge. Barry, is there a topic or two that you see that people and engineers are hungry for? Like, I need more information about this, or I just haven't gotten my hands wet enough with this, or, you know, I don't want to say what's hot out there. What's missing, or what do we need more of?
Well, I think the number one topic right now is understanding IT. Understanding how to make IT work with engineering and drive together for the same mission, because the engineer has to know the basics, even if there is an IT person who's specializing there. But the engineer has to know the basics, and vice versa. The IT guy has to learn there's life above 5 volts. And as a result, you have to have an interchange of information back and forth. And very often it's the IT guy that'll save your posterior when, you know, the material hits the rotating oscillator.
I remember my question now. You mentioned slip queuing, and I never worked at a station with equipment that with a turntable that needed, if I understand what slip queuing is, I was always able to queue something up, back it up some appropriate amount for, you know, how good or bad that idler wheel was in that turntable, whether it was a quarter turn or a third of a turn or less than a quarter turn. Barry, could you tell me what slip queuing is to you? What does that mean?
Oh, sure. Until we got the SP-10s, which would start almost instantly, you dealt with the turntables that you had. The QRKs and the Ruscos, they would take, as you say, anywhere from a quarter of a turn to a half a turn to hit speed. And you learned how to start it before you needed it. In the earlier days,
okay,
you had a turntable, the old gray turntables, they could take two-thirds of a turn to hit speed. So the only way that you could really do that is you'd use a record. There'd be felt on the top of the turntable, and so you'd put your finger on it, and you'd hold it until you needed it. And so you could cue real tight and then let go. Or in the case of a 45, in many cases, what you would do is you'd glue a little centerpiece, the little hub, on the top of a 40 of a 33, and then you put the record down, and then you hold the big record.
Oh, okay, that's a good idea. And now, I did try slip queuing a couple times, but I got a lot of rumble, you know, from the turntable and the felt rolling underneath the record I was holding. Now, I guess I should have had the pot turned down and let go of the record and turn the pot up at the same time.
Turn the pot down or the key switch off. Or I remember learning a cadence where to cue the record up, then you'd back it off two-thirds, you'd hit the start button, you'd snap the pot up, down, and back up, and there it was.
It's a dance. It's a dance, yeah. And what's great is you could get really tight segues when you do it. So if you had something with a really, really cold ending, you slip cue it right to the beginning of the song and hold it, and then literally, you know, you get your cold ending, you lift your finger, and boom, you're good to go. So it works really, really well to create tight segues.
And then to move to cartridges and then automation on computers where you hit the button and it's there. That's like, man, how did we ever live before?
And then some people were in both radio and TV. You'd run over the TV station and you'd have the 2-inch quadruplex VTR with a 10-second pre-roll.
Yes.
That was wild thing. Thinking back real quickly to the Shane and Young consoles, or maybe LPBs, or any kind of console, where sometimes engineers, you know, the program audition button, knob, lever, that's the word, lever switch above the pot, oftentimes had some extra contacts on it. And some engineers would take the 110 volts from the motor of the turntable and they'd wire it up to that switch. And so the poor engineer like me, I'm going into work on something, I lift the top up, pull the front down, reach my hand across, and all of a sudden I get 110 volts right about here. Ugh! Has that ever happened to you?
I still have a pair of dykes from doing some root search and destroy inside of an old console, useless wires, and one of them wasn't quite so useless.
Oh, no.
Still have them today as a reminder.
Chris Tarr would never do that. Chris would. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Barry. Go ahead.
I got another reminder for you from a station that used to complain about their 351 and how it sounded. And I looked under the head gate, and literally, I could put my fingernail through the gap in the head.
Oh my. Needed some heads. Yeah. Well, these days, Chris wouldn't wire the 110 volts to the switch. He'd give it an SNMP command.
Or you'd get it from one of Hank Landsberg's boxes.
Keep the dangerous stuff, you know, tucked away. Hey, this week in Radio Tech, we're about to take our last break before we come back with our tip of the week, and Chris Tarr, I know, has a doozy for us, and I don't know if Barry's got a tip of the week for us. I didn't ask him about this because I'm a really bad host. We'll see if Barry comes back with a tip of the week for us. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends, first of all, at Angry Audio. Angry Audio, hey, I just talked to Catfish today, And they are coming out with some cool new products I can't tell you about, but they've got plenty of old products that you can use every day in building studios, in building small studios at people's homes. They have the entire line of Studio Hub wiring products. These are the things with the RJ45 adapters, and then use Cat 5 cable to run your audio, whether it's balanced stereo audio or whether it's AES EBU or AES 3 audio. These adapters are just fantastic. If you go to the website, angryaudio.com, you can see a huge array of things, including what was just on the screen there, the headphone disconnector. Now, I'm not at my office right now, so I don't have the examples to show you. Maybe Chris Tarr would like to jump in here and tell us what Angry Audio or Studio Hub products he's finding the most useful lately in studio builds and maintenance. Chris, what are you finding useful these days?
Well, first of all, I was thinking about this. I had to remember to talk to Catfish and get him to get some merch with the Angry Audio logo on it. I just love that logo. I use Studio Hub and Angry Audio stuff all the time. One of the things about Studio Hub that I just love is I carry a whole bunch of different types of connectors in my Jeep, along with Cat 5 cables. And you can just so quickly make up any cable that you need right on the spot. No soldering, no trying to find the different parts. Just snap them together. So Studio Hub is fantastic for that. And then the boxes that Angry Audio makes are so rugged. And I mean, these are not for the faint of heart. These things have isolated transformers. They have real power supplies in them. I just installed not too long ago two distribution amplifiers. And these things are heavy and solid and RF proof. And they have the Studio Hub connectors in the back. They are just so well built, you know, and all of his gear is, you know, he comes up with some really great solutions, and kind of as an audio aficionado, really builds them very solidly and understands that things are going to get destroyed. You know, that things live in a, you know, sometimes a bad environment, and designs that gear to really survive in that environment. I was so impressed with the distribution amplifiers. I was looking for something, and I knew that he was building some good stuff. So just on a whim, I ordered two of his, and they are, they really are the nicest distribution amplifiers I've laid my hands on.
One thing to, and there's a reason, you know, one thing you should know about the designer, Michael Dosh, Catfish Dosh, is this is the same guy who designed some of the PR&E consoles, and he was also behind the Axia line of audio consoles. There's a lot of really strong engineering talent right there in Mike Dosh. He also, you know, he'll go to other people to get design improvements or ideas. So he's really excellent at this. And you're right, Chris, that the audio quality is super high, and so is the build qualities. Check it out, angryaudio.com. You can order Angry Audio gear from your favorite dealer. Just all kinds of good stuff. All right. Hey, another sponsor is Max Connect Wireless. I think we've got a quick video testimonial to show you. We'll be right back.
I'm Gary Morrill, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
Thanks to Gary Morrill and other really happy customers of Max Connect Wireless. And a big shout out to Josh Bone, who had the great idea of communicating and negotiating with the carriers, the cell carriers, to get prioritized data. So thanks a lot, Max Connect Wireless. There's the website, MaxxConnect, maxconnect.com. Thanks a lot, Josh, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. It's time for our tips of the week, and I think I'm gonna hit Chris Tarr up first, see what his tip of the week is. He says it's really good. So, Chris, what is it?
if I do say so myself. excuse me. You know, one of the things that still comes up now, and obviously it's something that's very important, one of the, I hate to say it, one of the few responsibilities left are EAS logs and station logging. And, you know, there's so many different ways to do it. There's, you know, printing out sheets. There's trying to save it on the machine, on the NDEC itself. It used to be collecting little receipts. So many different ways to do it. And I was trying to find a way to make it easy to do, make it paper-free, and make it easy to deal with. So I came up with these, what I call just regular station logs, which double for EAS logs. And I think we have an example here we can put on the screen. This is what I use for, this one is for my stations in Milwaukee. And basically what this is the cover sheet that is the entire station log, EAS, if there's a problem, if we're off the air, anything like that, we can document it. And as you can see, I attached the EAS log for the week. There's, if you scroll back up, there's a section there to write in information on, you know, anything that may have gone wrong. And more importantly, at the bottom, it talks about the station operating without human supervision according to FCC rules. And so essentially that covers all of your bases in terms of station control, station logging. And I actually got a real positive comment from an inspector who saw this, came in and took a look and said, this is great. It covers all of the bases. You know, I can see that you've reviewed the logs. There's a place in there to note if there's any discrepancies, all on one page. And I do this all paperless. So I actually use Acrobat Pro. There's plenty of other PDF programs out there, but I save that cover sheet as a PDF. I can go in. All I have to do is put the date in. My signature is an actual watermarked signature, so you know it's me. And with the PDF program, I can take the PDF download of the EAS log, you know, attach it to that cover sheet, put the date in, and you're done. It takes me, I have, you know, probably 6 or 7 clusters of stations that I do logging for, and it takes maybe 15, 20 minutes to do the entire thing. I copy and paste the date and put the pages in there and then drag and drop my signature and it's done. And so you've got it paperless. You can do it every week. It's easy to find. It's easy to deal with. And it is completely 100% legal. And it covers all of your bases. So, you know, if you're responsible for doing station logs, this is a great, great way to do it.
Chris, which PDF editor are you liking to handle these?
There are so many that you can use. The one I use is, mm-hmm. you know, it's expensive, but I, you know, it's what I'm used to is Adobe Acrobat. Mm-hmm. You have to get the pro version to do that for the signatures and everything else. But what's great about that is you can actually on the side, you can set up workflows. So I have this all in a workflow. And so literally, again, to do one station, if there's nothing else to log, if it's just a normal week and everything's okay, it's like a minute and a half to do a station log because it's all presets. But there are, you know, there's Qt PDF. There's all kinds of different editors out there that you can use. But again, I like this one because you can do the workflows and your signature is a certificate. So I can put my name in as a certificate and lock the PDF. So if anybody changes it, it says that right on the PDF. So in terms of legality, it basically, you know, no one else can sign it but me, and no one else can modify it after I've reviewed it and signed it.
Man, we ought to do a show that's a lesson in that. I'd love to know how to do that.
Yeah, good it's idea. Pretty cool stuff. And again, it evolved. You know, it started out with, you know, just a cover sheet, and then I print it all out. Then it went to PDFs, and then it went to signed PDFs, and then it went to, you know, the wording for the unattended operation to become a station log. And so, you know, it kind of evolved over time to now it's just one, you know, one sheet, and I have it for each one of my stations.
Good deal. Good deal. I'm serious. We should do a show on with showing your workflow. Hey, thanks, Chris. Great tip. We got to run pretty soon. Let's ask Barry real quick. Barry, do you have a tip you'd like to leave our viewers and listeners with?
Sure. From our presentation week before last, document. Document everything. The more you put down, the more you're going to be able to take care of things later on when issues arise.
Amen.
Called in to help a station, and I was very pleasantly surprised to find logs that I filled out 30 years ago were still there.
Wow.
One big change, and this is a wonderful change for us today. We have it with our pocket. We got the cell phones. We can take pictures and we can take videos of things that we take apart so we know exactly how they go back together. And this is a large part of the article that we have top posted on the front page of the BDR this week. You know, good maintenance program will help you a lot.
Great advice. Document everything. And yes, this will certainly help you out. I need to remember this more often, more often. I wish I had this when I was 12 years old, taking my parents' TV set apart. That would have been, really helpful.
It was always,
we got to go. That's right. Barry Mishkin, thank you for being with us. It's been an absolute delight. I appreciate you taking an hour out of your day to come spend with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Chris Tarr, thank you for being here. I appreciate your companionship and co-hosting the show. Next week, our guest is going to be someone who I know very well. He's actually kind of one of my bosses at the Telos Alliance. It's Scott Stiefel. And Scott is the COO, the Chief Operating Officer at Telos. And, you know, supply chain has been a real issue for all kinds of industries, including the broadcast industry. Scott's going to address supply chain issues and, you know, how companies like the one that I work for, how we have been trying to mitigate this by even redesigning some gear because a part's no longer available. So that's coming up next week. Hey, I want to thank Suncast for doing the show today, for producing it. Suncast, thank you so much. I appreciate you very much. On behalf of Chris Tarr, I'm Kirk Harnack, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.